Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 17th. The war in the Middle East is now 194 days old. I'm Anya Kravine, Senior Director of the Israel Program and National Security Network at Foundation for Defensive Democracies, standing in again for John Schanzer on today's FDD Morning Brief. Here in Israel, everyone has the same question on their mind. Will the IDF respond to Iran's massive attack on the Jewish state that occurred over the weekend? When will it happen and what will it look like? Or will Jerusalem bend to the will of the US and other allies that are urging restraint? More on that later in the show. My guest today is Lazer Berman, diplomatic correspondent for the Times of Israel, whose clear-eyed analysis during this war has been incredibly valuable. We will speak with Lazer in just a few short minutes about the multi-front war that Israel's fighting live right here on the FDD Morning Brief. But before we get to Lazer, let's talk about Jerusalem's major dilemma when it comes to a response to the Iranian attack, potentially the biggest swarm of missiles and drones ever seen on the battlefield. The Iranian attack was an abysmal failure for the mullahs, with 99% of the weapons shot down in the air, only one Israeli casualty, a little girl who sustained serious injuries from rocket shrapnel and reportedly remains in critical condition, and negligible damage to one Israeli Air Force base, albeit an important base. In light of Israel and its allies' stellar military achievement of repelling the barrage, Biden reportedly told Bibi to take the win and stand down, while the White House leaked to the press that Washington would not support an Israeli retaliation. European and Arab allies have also urged restraint and reiterated concerns that a response by Israel could take the region up an escalation ladder that no one wants. We are now more than 3 days after the Iranian attack, and although Israel continues to operate against Tehran's subsidiaries in Gaza and Lebanon, cool heads seems to have prevailed in Jerusalem, and there has been no visible direct retaliation against the Islamic Republic so far. While some elements of Netanyahu's government are calling for a quick and forceful response against the Islamic regime in Tehran, Israel's war cabinet seems to be carefully considering its options. So what are their options? Well, they range from a cyber response to attacking refineries or drone factories, or perhaps going after the Iranian nuclear program. And there are probably a whole menu of other assets that Israel could target. If Israel attacks decisively, it could either dangerously escalate matters or could successfully reestablish deterrence. Another option for Israel is to exercise strategic restraint. In other words, telling Washington, okay, we'll back down from this one and try to capitalize on some of the goodwill while solidifying the emerging regional alliance in the face of Iranian aggression. My take, best case scenario is for Israel is that it manages to do a little bit of both, work with the US to calibrate a response that sends the correct message to Iran while strengthening support from the US and regional allies that could allow Israel to achieve some strategic wins in this war. That is a tall order, but hope springs eternal. And now for your headlines. Headline one, after Hamas rejected yet another hostage prisoner deal last week, at least the fifth deal that Hamas has turned down, US State Department spokesman Matt Miller said that Hamas is the barrier and the obstacle to a ceasefire deal that Gazans desperately need. Team Biden seems to be finally losing patience with Hamas, who the administration has been in negotiations with on a pretty much ongoing basis since the early days of the war. However, the hostage talks have been fruitless since the last tranche of hostages were returned to Israel in November. The issue of the hostages remain an open wound in the Israeli psyche, and I don't expect there will be any resolution or even talk of concluding the war in Gaza until the 130 hostages, including women and children, are brought home. Headline two. Despite tensions between Amman and Jerusalem over the war in Gaza, the Jordanian Air Force joined the U.S.-led coalition to help propel Iran's weekend attack against Israel, shooting down dozens of projectiles in Jordanian airspace during the massive Iranian attack on Israel. There was even one report that Jordan permitted Israeli jets into their airspace to shoot down drones and missiles. The Jordanian government has been trying to keep this on the down low and play down the narrative. While it is definitely in Jordan's interest to defend its own skies, and there is certainly no love lost between the Jordanian monarchy and the regime in Tehran, the seemingly flawless coordination between the Jordanian and Israeli air forces over the weekend is an important reminder of how dependent these countries are on each other for their security. And headline three, after promising a united diplomatic response, the Biden administration is working on new sanctions in response to Iran's attack on Saturday. The U.S. is reportedly coordinating with other G7 nations on sanctions against the regime. Overall, sanctions on Iran are a good thing, but certainly nowhere near enough to deter the regime, and almost certainly not enough to convince Israel that the mullahs have been dealt a punishment that matches the crime. All right, I'm now pleased to introduce Laser Berman to the show for his take on how Israel's multi-front war is going. Laser is a reserve captain in the IDF, holds an MA in military operations, spent time as a researcher in a DC think tank, and is currently a PhD student in the War Studies Department at King's College of London. Of his many impressive professional and academic achievements, a most notable accomplishment is that Laser is also a member of FDD's very own National Security Network. Welcome, Laser.
Good morning.
So good to have you. Laser, you're a war scholar. What can you tell us about the size and scope of the Iranian attack last weekend?
Sure. So I think it's important to realize, first of all, this was unprecedented for a number of reasons. First of all, unprecedented because it's the first time another country has directly attacked Israel since 1991. Of course, that was the Scud attacks from Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And I think that experience really set Israel off on the course of developing this very impressive multi-layered missile defense. It was also unprecedented because it was larger than other ballistic missile attacks that we have seen. The ones that we have seen most recently, of course, are Russian attacks on Ukraine. There are many similarities in the tactics used here and the attempts to get through the air defenses, but this is bigger and more complex than even what we've seen Russia strike Ukraine with at the height of their attack there. So this is really something that is a game changer in many ways. It has certainly made countries around the world, certainly in the region, wake up to the threat that Iran poses and the importance of cooperating with Israel, cooperating with the United States, because these are the countries that have, really the only countries that have the ability to do what we saw happen over the weekend.
Yeah, and it was quite a sight to be seen. Switching gears a tiny bit, Iran has a decades-long strategy of targeting its adversaries through its regional proxies and rarely from Iranian soil. The strategy has been largely successful because it gives the regime plausible deniability and often allows the regime to evade consequences. Why did it so dramatically deviate from this strategy over the weekend?
That's a good question. And the expectation was that it had decided ahead of time, even signaled that it was going to act quite differently. So what is the reason? I think there's it mostly comes from a weakness that the regime in Iran feels like it has been spreading, or that image has been spread to the actors in the region, to its enemies and also to its people in recent years and certainly in recent months. If we go back and we can just certainly look at what Israel has been doing on the northern border, where they've been killing Hezbollah officials, also Hamas, but also IRGC generals. In December, you had another Iranian general who was killed. And then, of course, on April 1st, you had the strike in Damascus that really set off the recent chain of events. So it's a lot of feeling like it is seen as weak in the region, and that's something that the regime is quite afraid of. But there was also internal dynamics and internal events that made it seem quite weak. If you remember, in February, there was that ISIS double bombing at the four-year anniversary of the Qasem Soleimani killing, near his grave even. And that killed over 80 civilians and made Iran look quite incapable of even defending itself on a day like that. And what did it decide to do? It struck back at Jaish al-Adl camps in Pakistan. Now, Pakistan, quite a capable military, it's nuclear armed as well. They struck back and Iran immediately sought to de-escalate there and didn't come off as looking very powerful. Then you add on October 7th and Iran seems to be struggling to show that it is indeed taking part in this struggle against Israel. But of course, Hamas, one of its smaller proxies, quite capable, of course, but it's not Hezbollah, is the one that's leading the fight against Israel. So as it's getting battered up in the north and Israel has a ton of advantages up there, it really needed to show that it was strong, that it was a reliable partner for its axis and also to its people that don't like it very much, that it was capable of protecting them and of trying to control what was happening on the ground. They also saw an opportunity, I think. I'm sure they noticed the increasing diplomatic pressure on Israel, and the fact that they could say that this April 1st strike was on a diplomatic facility, it was on a consulate, I think kind of raised their expectations that the Western opprobrium at Israel or the Western allies would restrain Israel more than they did. I don't think they pictured the result being this kind of, I call it the debut of this regional air defense coalition against Iran that has been under work for years. It really debuted because of Iran. So I think it was mostly because of weakness, but they saw an opportunity here because of the diplomatic pressure that's been publicly applied to Israel from its closest friends.
Thanks, Laser. It's certainly a question that's been keeping me up at night. I mean, someone who's been watching this conflict like you, not just since October 7th, for years, it was such a change in strategy from them. And I think most analysts got it wrong, that most analysts that I've been listening to wouldn't have anticipated that. So it's helpful to have that historical context. And thanks for offering that. Going back to the war in Gaza, which is, of course, the war that you've been following very closely since October 7th, and I believe actually reported from inside Gaza, and definitely spent a lot of time in the envelope. We're coming up on 6 months since Israel launched its ground invasion. How do you assess the campaign up to this point?
Sure. So let me start with the negative side. Let me be a little bit pessimistic, and then we'll finish this answer with some happier notes. Israel has been very clear about what its war aims are. It was initially to destroy the military and civil capabilities of Hamas in Gaza. A couple weeks later, they added that under pressure, I think, domestically, they added the goal of bringing back all of the hostages. And also Netanyahu has added making sure that Gaza cannot be used as a launching platform for future attacks on Israel. As of now, none of those aims have been achieved. And we're, like, as you said, 6 months in. I think the world, Israel's closest allies, the U.S., many of them in Europe, talk much less about the military defeat of Hamas, if at all. I mean, it wasn't a surprise that he said this, but EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, after that emergency meeting last night, didn't even mention Hamas, certainly didn't mention their military defeat. So that is the negative side. That is a problem that does come from some, I think, mismanagement of the diplomatic side. But on the ground, Israel has said all along, Netanyahu has said all along, this is going to be a slow, deliberate campaign. This is going to be a year of fighting, and then we have many years of follow-up ahead. What is the positive side? If you go back to 2014, the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge, there was internal IDF meetings where they said that we can never go back and try to take the Gaza Strip. It would cost some 700 dead, more soldiers kidnapped. It's just something that is beyond our capabilities. If you look on the ground, the tactical fight, even though Israel hadn't prepared for it, even though it took Israel by surprise, even though division commanders hadn't commanded their divisions in battle, even though a lot of tactics and techniques had to be developed while it was fighting Hamas, the tactical fight has gone stunningly well. A little over 250, 260, unfortunately, IDF casualties on the ground. But Israel maneuvers where it wants. It goes where it wants. Hamas has proven that it cannot stop IDF maneuver. What it's able to do is kind of, you know, strike an RPG, pick up an RPG, fire a sniper here and there, kind of these very small guerrilla tactics that certainly do take some toll, but it doesn't affect what Israel's doing in the big picture. What the big question is now is the Rafah operation. It's that last city. It sits on the Egyptian-Gaza border. That's where the vast majority of those Russian, North Korean, Iranian weapons that you saw being used on October 7th and in other attacks came through. Of course, it's where more than a brigade of Hamas fighters remain. It's a brigade plus all the ones that went south. It's the brigade that kidnapped Gilad Shalit. They pulled out some other attacks. If it remains intact, that will be the nucleus from which Hamas retakes the Gaza Strip. So that certainly has to be smashed apart, despite what Biden and others might say. And we also see that Hamas is re-entering areas where the IDF leaves. Now, IDF has said all along that is going to happen, that they try to reassert civil control, but that is something that Israel has to start going back into. We saw the operation in the Shifa hospital. We see what's going on in Nusayrat right now. Israel is going, and also in Beit Hanun, Israel is going to have to continue over the coming years to keep going back and degrading these capabilities as Hamas keeps trying to show that it is actually still alive and kicking. So it's a long fight. We're certainly beyond the height of it. There's only one IDF brigade left in the Gaza Strip from a height of 28. But it is a long fight that is going in the right direction for Israel. But of course, this Rafah fight, that's the next one. It seems to be that the preparations are really starting to move. I can see the gears starting to turn here. And that will have to start with the civilian evacuation. And then the IDF can go in force.
And it sounds like, from what you're saying, that in order to deal with Rafah, there would need to be a surge of IDF.
Yes, but I think if we look over the trend of the way the IDF has fought, the first stage was the Gaza City operation, which was basically four brigades in one city moving very slowly, fighting very aggressively. If we move south after the first ceasefire to Khan Yunis, that is one division. So there's four divisions in the north, and there was one division in Khan Yunis. That was my division, Division 98. A much more targeted operation. They could be less aggressive. Why? Because Israel was learning itself. The IDF was learning how to operate together in this battlefield over the weeks. And also the intelligence that was coming off the battlefield helped be much more targeted. So I assume that Rafah would be even more targeted than the Khan Yunis operation, but it's not the targeted the way the Biden administration might picture it. You know, 20 special forces soldier kick in a window and pull someone out. When Israel tried that during the Rafah operation, where they were able to successfully evacuate, extract two hostages, it was such a small unit that when they came under attack, Israel had to be very aggressive in their fire to protect them to get out. So there has to be a certain size of the force that goes in to control the ground, and then they can be careful and targeted. So it is not. I don't think it'll be massive. Might even be a small division, several brigades. But that's probably about it. This is not one of the best Hamas units sitting in Rafah, but it's certainly one that does have a lot of experience in fighting the IDF.
Thanks. It sounds like the Rafah battle, the Gaza battle, that sort of sounds like it's culminating with this Rafah operation is far from over. And also we have this looming situation between Israel and Iran, the IRGC. So how does Iran's most powerful subsidiary in the region, Hezbollah, factor into all this? And, you know, with the last minute and a half, how would you put that into words?
Sure. I think Hezbollah is kind of stuck in a position it doesn't want to be in. It was built for two things. One, to surprise Israel in an October 7th type attack with its Radwan force. That's not going to happen, obviously, because Israel immediately surged troops to the north. And is not going to be taken by surprise again in an October 7th-like fashion. But the big reason why they've built up their rocket and missile capability with obviously Iran's direction and backing is so that they can serve as a deterrent to keep Israel from striking Iran's nuclear program. So that really would dictate the way they're used. Iran certainly doesn't want to waste them on an attack that might hurt Israel, but then they've shot their shot and they've lost that deterrent, which has been the product of investment over the decades. Right now, the military-on-military fight between Israel and Hezbollah is going well for Israel. You can see the quality of Israel's intelligence compared to what it knew about Gaza, in that it is striking senior commanders across the organizations over the border, killed over 250 Hezbollah fighters, lost, I believe, 12 IDF soldiers. So the balance there is very favorable for the IDF. Most of the Radwan force has been chased off the border because they're vulnerable there and they're not going to be able to get into Israel anyway right now. So it's a position that Hezbollah does not want to be in, but they can't stop fighting as long as their quote-unquote brothers in Gaza continue to fight. They're waiting, it seems, for some sort of diplomatic way to climb down the tree. But as long as Hamas continues to feel that as it plays for time, the situation gets worse and worse for Israel and the West continues to pressure Israel, it has very little reason to be more flexible or to make any concessions to Israel. And we've seen that, you know, the U.S. and other countries applied pressure to Israel and Hamas keeps entrenching its positions and digging its heels in. So I think Hezbollah is getting hammered pretty hard. This would have turned into a full-blown war. Israel would have gone into Lebanon were it not for what's going on in the south. And there are many people that have pushed for that. But for now, I think Israel's doing well, keeping the fight as it is in the north. I don't think it helps Israel to go into a full-blown war in the north right now, though it will happen in the coming years, I'm convinced. But the question is, how do we get Hezbollah to stop fighting so we can get those 60,000 civilians back to their homes in the north? That's a complex political question that Israel's leadership have to answer. But on the military front, Israel's doing quite well in the north.
Great. Laser, I can talk to you about this all day long. Hopefully we'll have future opportunities. Thank you so much for joining us today on the FDD Morning Brief.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure. Thanks.
Okay, here's what FDD has on tap for you today. FDD's Ruel Marc Gerecht and Council on Foreign Relations Ray Takia are out with a new piece in the New York Times on why a strong U.S.-Israel relationship is imperative to keep Iran at bay. It's only a matter of time before Israel responds to Tehran's attack. Instead of containment and de-escalation, they argue, the U.S. must make Tehran understand there are consequences to their actions. Andrea Stricker, Deputy Director of FDD's Nonproliferation and Biodefense Program, wrote a new piece on Iranian sanctions, or lack thereof. By refusing to enforce current sanctions, the Biden administration is aiding Iran in financing its terror regime. Biden is more concerned with appeasement and quiet in the Middle East than leveraging the power of the U.S. economy. Andrea poses the question in her piece, will the recently announced sanctions go far enough? And finally, FDD's chief executive Mark Dubowitz and senior fellow Jacob Nagel discussed the stakes riding on Israel's response to Iran's attack in their new Daily Mail article. They argue that Biden's lack of support for an Israeli response is short-term thinking, while Israel must think long-term when navigating the region. After this weekend, the threat of a nuclear weapon being deployed from inside Iran toward Israel is closer to reality. Israel's response, whatever it looks like, must restore deterrence. That's it for today, people. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD. And support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Friday for another episode of the FDD Morning Brief. Jonathan Conricus will be back hosting Yossi Cooperwasser, an expert on Israeli intelligence and security. Formerly, Yossi served as head of research in the IDF Military Intelligence Division and as director general of Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs. It's been great to host while John has been traveling, and I'm very much looking forward to coming back. I'm Enya Kravine, signing off. See you next time.